I want to first of all thank all of you who were kind enough to send me cards or messages or gifts for my birthday yesterday. I was kind of dreading yesterday as the first birthday without Christy because she always went out of her way to make a point to make it so special. And you guys made the day not only bearable, but very happy. So thank you very much for that. And as a bonus, since I have moved here to Florida, I've come to learn about a very special way to celebrate your birthday. So I'm going to ask a question, and you raise your hand if you know what I'm talking about. How many of you know what Florida Man is? Raise your hand. All right, so only a fraction of you. Have I got a gift to pass on to you? So for those of you who are natives to this wonderful state, you may not be aware of the fact that the rest of the country thinks that all the strangest, weirdest people live in Florida. Now, that's not my opinion. I'm just saying this is what other people say. Although many of you are already nodding in agreement. Most of you are probably thinking, well, they're not natives, right? But so there's this thing you can do where you can go to Google and you can simply type in the phrase Florida Man and your birthday, the month and day of your birth. Now, don't do it right now because I know some of you do this. Some of you even post stuff on social media during the hours of our worship, which is easy to figure out. So don't do it right now. But I'm going to give you an example. So when I heard about the phenomenon known as Florida Man, I typed in September 7th, Florida Man. And it honestly couldn't be better if I wrote it myself to have the most fun on my birthday. USA Today headline, September 7th, 2018. Florida man drunk and naked allegedly set house on fire in failed cookie baking attempt. And the first paragraph, and if you're an Office fan, you will really enjoy this first paragraph. An apologetic but confused man greeted Florida firefighters after he allegedly started a house fire as he tried to bake cookies on a George Foreman grill. So, and it's actually Mike Ross. It was funny. No, actually, it sounds like something. I mean, if there's any easier way to make a bunch of chocolate chip cookies, I'm down for it, right? So anyway, so that's the Florida Man phenomenon. Go home tonight and have fun. Look up your birthday and type that in. Well, this morning, I talked with you about some doubts that are raised against Christianity because I believe if faith is valuable and important, you ought to be willing to subject it to critical evaluation. But I also think the same is true with atheism. So that's what I actually want to do tonight in the course of this lesson. I want to make sure that if somebody is contemplating giving up their faith, that they critically evaluate just exactly what it is that they are accepting and what the consequences of atheism actually are. And I certainly don't want this to just be my imagination as to what I think they are. There's a reason that I've entitled the lesson tonight, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, because there is a book by an atheist philosopher named Alex Rosenberg by that very title, in which he spells out what the world is like according to atheism. And what I want to do tonight is just simply share with you what he says the world is like, and then take a close look at that and examine what he has to say. At the very start of the book, he's very clear and very straightforward about what you are accepting as a view of the world if you are an atheist. So individual human life is meaningless, without a purpose, and without ultimate moral value. And lest you think that that's just the imaginations of a philosopher in the ivory tower, I want you to know that in many years of experience of conversations with my unbelieving friends on social media, I have found this to be a very common belief. Some of you who've been around here for a long time will remember me talking about an extensive conversation I had on Facebook a few years ago when this terrible tragedy took place at the Cincinnati Zoo. How many of y'all remember the story of Harambee, the silverback gorilla? Yeah, it was a terrible story. This little kid, I think he was maybe four, got away from his parents' supervision, slipped down into the enclosure, and the gorilla began to be extremely aggressive in the way that it started to go after the kid. And so the people in charge of the zoo had to make a decision. How do we handle this? And they decided the only way to save the child was to put the gorilla down. Very tragic circumstance. So when that happened, I was curious. So I just posted on Facebook one day, and I asked specifically for my non-Christian or unbelieving friends to explain, on what basis would you prefer to save the child's life over the gorilla's life? Now, I explain, I mean, I know how I would answer that. I would answer that by thinking about the truth that we read at the start of service tonight. Would you go back there with me to Genesis chapter 1? The opening chapter of the Bible talks about all of creation as the good work of God, including the animals. And that's why we as Christians believe that we should be good stewards of our created order, including animals. But we also believe that God has made human beings with a fundamentally different value and role. Genesis 1:26, then God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over the, all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And then this point becomes explicit if you go on over to chapter 9, after the account of the flood, when the Lord explains that humanity is free to consume animal life. But the Lord says this in chapter 9 of Genesis in verse 3, "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. As I gave you the green plants, I give you everything." But then in verse 6, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image." So what the scriptures teach is that God, as the transcendent creator, has given humanity a certain role, a certain function, a certain status. And that makes humanity distinct from and superior to animals. Again, not to justify cruelty to animals, quite the contrary. The reason we try to protect silverback gorillas that are a rare species is precisely because we have the ability to look after animals that might be endangered. But it also means that if we were to have to make this tragic choice, and I realize there was debate back then as if there was another way, but if, for the sake of argument, you had to put down one or the other, there is a Christian basis for the answer of why you would save the little child's life but not the gorilla's. But that's because I believe in God as the one who has made humanity in his image. What if you don't believe in God? How would you justify saving the child's life? I think it was this conversation that really was like the splash of cold water on my face to shock me into understanding just how deeply ingrained unbelief is in our culture. My friends who made the comments that you're about to see are some of the kindest, warmest, nicest people you could ever imagine. And yet when one of my friends tried to answer the question, he said this, "You defend your tribe. And sapiens, sapiens, we be." So we're in the human tribe. The gorilla's in the gorilla tribe. You just look out for your tribe. The only obligations that would seem to exist are within one's own tribe. So there is no overarching moral order. It's just simply our tribe, humanity, versus the gorilla tribe. Another one of my friends, one of my oldest friends that I have from elementary school days, said, "Brotherhood of man is a social construct, just like religion, that unites the tribe, the society, and produces stability and growth. It's a force for good, or can be, should be, but it seems to me that the value of human life, anything, comes from that social stability and security, the social norm." In other words, there is no ultimate right or wrong. It's just simply a product of your social norms. She went on to say, "To assign value to one life over another," which was the original question I posted, "is relative to each situation in society." So when this philosopher says there's no ultimate moral value, that's just not an esoteric theory. That's what a lot of my friends believe. But here is the issue. If morality is purely tribal, you just do what's good for your tribe, and it's purely a social construct, and there is no objective moral value, then what about issues like sex trafficking of little children? I mean, if morality is tribal, then you know as well as I do, there are tribes and cultures in our world that not only do this, they justify doing it. And so if there is no overarching belief in right and wrong, and it simply matters from one tribe to another, from one society to another, then my question to my Facebook friends is, on what basis could you condemn sex trafficking in other cultures? And my old elementary school friend said, well, maybe I didn't take enough philosophy classes because I don't see those questions as the same category or topic. Well, with all due respect, you don't have to take one philosophy class to know you shouldn't sell little girls into slavery for the sexual gratification of other people. But that's because of a belief I have in God, who has created us in His image and therefore has given all of us, male and female, you may remember that Genesis said, a certain amount of dignity. In fact, just this weekend, I don't know how this popped up on my Twitter feed, but I saw a tweet from a former Muslim who said, because I'm capable of being ethical and moral without religion or God, I don't need to believe in books written thousands of years ago by misogynistic men who considered women as less humans. I'm going to pause here. I agree with the first part of her statement. I'm going to talk about it more in a second. I believe you can be good and moral without believing in God. That's not really the issue tonight. So remember that. I'll come back to it. But what I do want you to notice is, she refers to misogynistic men. And if you don't know what that means, is men who hate women. Which prompted a question in my mind. If you don't believe in ethical and moral guidance from God, why is misogyny wrong? Because after all, in a lot of cultures, it works pretty well for them. In a lot of societies, that is exactly how they are constructed. She went on to give this quote from Einstein, a man's ethical behavior should be based effectually on sympathy. But wait a minute, the word should, that is a moral word. In fact, it's a moral imperative, what you should do. Where do you get such terms if you don't believe there is a God who says what should be done and what should not be done? Now, let me again emphasize the point that I said a moment ago. I agreed with this statement. I'm capable of being ethical and moral without God. I believe that. In fact, I believe there are many atheists who live better moral lives than many professed Christians. That is no great surprise to us. Remember what Paul says to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 5 about the man with his father's wife? He says, you're letting this happen, and pagans don't even let this happen. So it's not a news flash for us that there are many people who are not believers at all who live exemplary moral lives. That's not really what I'm talking about. Here is what I'm talking about. What I want to know is, how do you explain why some things are right or wrong if you don't believe in God? How do you justify, how do you ground a belief as right or wrong? I realize you can live a good life. I want to know, how do you define it as a good life? How do you justify it as good? How do you explain why it is good? It's difficult. In fact, I asked this person on Twitter that very question. And I've gotten some comments from other people. It's my birthday, so I didn't do a lot with it. But I got a lot of comments from people who basically said that morality is subjective. There is no objective grounding. Well, that's the problem, though. Do you see? You can't make these grandiose pronouncements about why I don't need God to know misogyny is wrong and then not be able to explain why you think it's wrong. You can't make these grand statements about how you don't need God and then start talking about what people should do if you can't offer a reason, an objective reason that transcends culture and tribe as to why one thing is right and the other thing is wrong. Now, in Rosenberg's book, the only explanation that I could see for why things are moral is evolution. blind, random chance produced by genetic variation and natural selection. Here's the problem, though. As he says, there's lots of evidence that natural selection is not very good at picking out true beliefs. Let me illustrate this like this. Let's grant, for the sake of argument, the whole kit and caboodle theory of evolution. Random variation, genetic variation, natural selection. What that means is, if you're able to wind the film back and hit play, some other outcome would happen. Follow what I'm saying? Because it's just random variation. So there's a possibility that if you wound it back, hit play, and we went forward, that, you know, we'd all look like the people in Avatar, right? We'd be big and blue, a good color, of course, and we'd have tails that do weird things. I don't know, but I mean, we would look like the people in Avatar. And you realize there's not one right and one wrong, right? It's just the random result of evolution. Follow? Well, if the same is true for moral beliefs, do you see that while on this way the film has gone, torturing little babies is wrong, do you see that if you rewind the film and hit play and it goes again, that because morals are nothing more than just another product of random variation, that there could be a world in which torturing babies was right? There'd be no difference than in whether we look like we do or the people in Avatar. And that's what this professor is saying when he says there's lots of evidence that natural selection can't pick out true beliefs. There are lots of moral values and ethical norms that enlightened people reject, but which Mother Nature has strongly selected for. In other words, there are things we all think are wrong, but you know, really, it seems like evolution prompts us in these areas. Here's what he mentions in particular. Racism and xenophobia, the fear of strangers, are optimally adapted to maximize the representation of your genes. In other words, back in caveman days, in his view, you've got your tribe, and you look one way, and you've got that tribe over there. They look a little different, and they're strangers. And you've got one creek. What he's saying is, you know what natural selection really forces you to do because of your own instinct for survival? Kill those people so you get the water so you can live. And do you realize that's absolutely no different in thinking than what my friend said when he said, well, you choose the little boy over the gorilla because that's our tribe. That's tribal morality. And if morals are nothing more than the result of evolution, they are just as random as the color of your eyes, or whether you have an earlobe that is loose or attached, or whether you can roll your R's or you can't, or a million other things that aren't really right or wrong. It's just the variation of what is. This really came home to me when Christy and I were watching a science fiction show one time, the premise of which was that the Nazis won the Second World War. Which, of course, he talks about in the book, are like exhibit A of racism and xenophobia, right? And it's easy to think that there's some twists and turns that could have happened in history where maybe they'd go to. And we were watching this episode one night, and this guy is driving a truck through Nazi territory, and it breaks down, and the Nazi sheriff pulls him over. And you're thinking, oh, no, he's going to be terrible. And actually, he's quite friendly. But while they're talking, this white stuff that almost looks like snow, but it's not cold enough to be snow, starts falling. And the guy goes, what is this stuff? And the sheriff goes, oh, it's the incinerator from the hospital. Today is when they incinerate all of the handicapped and terminally ill people. And I don't know if it was because of Christie's illness or just because I wasn't expecting that, but it hit me hard to think you could have rewound history and there's a world in which that would be moral. If morality is nothing more than the result of pure blind chance. So my point to you is, if atheism is true, then the simple fact is morality, objective morality, doesn't exist. Not saying you can't be a good person, but what I'm saying is it's hard for you to explain why you're good. It's hard to explain what good is. But I want you to see that it gets worse. Think about it like this. If there is no right and wrong, on what basis could we hold people accountable for their actions? Well, according to atheism, we aren't accountable for our actions. Why do they think that? Well, here's a picture of a brain. Now, we as Christians believe that in addition to the physical body, there is something else beyond the physical that we have. We call it the soul. And that the soul has capabilities beyond simply the physical. It certainly, under normal circumstances, uses our physical body, uses our brain. We believe the soul and its properties, like the mind and intellect, and like love and free will, are distinct from the body and can survive death. That's why Jesus can say things like, to the thief, today you will be with me in paradise, and it means something. But if that isn't true, and all that exists is matter, particles of stuff, then what that means is there isn't a soul, and there isn't a mind, and there isn't an intellect. All there is the brain. And what Rosenberg says is the mind just is the brain and nothing more. Now, because we believe there's something more than the body, we believe that we make choices. We can know what good is and what bad is, and we can act accordingly. But if all that exists is the brain, a clump of matter, then it is no different than this paper I am wadding up. And this clump of paper has no free will. It simply operates purely on the basis of the laws of physics. Like I'm going to demonstrate one of those right now, the law of gravity. Look at that reflex. Did you see that? That was like Spider-Man. That was amazing, Spencer. All right. So what goes up must come down. It's the law of gravity. Now, if the mind is nothing more than the brain, and the brain is nothing more than matter, then the brain is like that clump of paper in that it's purely subject to the laws of nature. And if that is the case, our mind is no more free than that clump of paper was. Our mind is simply the brain subject to the laws of physics. And so Rosenberg says, every state of my brain is fixed by physical facts. There is no free will, just the feeling or the illusion of introspection. So not only does morality not exist, free will doesn't exist. Everything you do is simply the result of physics working on your brain. But I would say to you, it gets even worse than that. Because you might be sitting there right now saying, that is absurd. Of course free will exists. Why, I'm thinking about something I'm going to choose to do after we get done here with worship. Rosenberg says, no, you're not. So let me illustrate it like this. Here is a picture of one of my favorite thinkers contemplating one of my favorite thoughts. And as an aside, I really feel like, because I believe in free will, I chose not to get donuts on my birthday. Although with every fiber of my being, I wanted to, all right? But so Homer's thinking about what I think about most of the time here. So he's thinking about donuts. Now, if the mind is just simply the brain, and the brain is just matter, then there really is no difference between Homer's brain and the donut, is there? Which then leads to this question. What does the donut think about? And of course the answer is, the donut doesn't think about anything. If donuts could think, they would be running from where I live, right? Because they would know they're going to be consumed. But donuts don't think about anything. Well, what Rosenberg says is, neither do we. When consciousness assures us that we have thoughts about stuff, it has to be wrong. The brain non-consciously stores information in thoughts, but thoughts are not about stuff. You don't think about anything because your brain can no more think about anything than a donut can. So if you walked into Professor Rosenberg's office one day and you saw him working on his book and you said, hey, Professor Rosenberg, what are you thinking about? What is the only answer he could truly give? Nothing, because you can't think about anything. So according to atheism, thinking doesn't exist. But it gets worse than that. You may be thinking, well, of course I'm thinking. I know I'm thinking right now because I'm conscious, and I'm consciously aware of the fact that I'm thinking. But wait a minute. How do you know you're consciously aware? Just like the donut can't think, is the donut even conscious? Of course not. And if the mind is just the brain, and the brain is just matter, and the brain is nothing fundamentally different than the donut, then not only is the donut not conscious, neither is Homer. Now, to be fair, in most of the Simpsons episodes, he doesn't appear to be conscious. But you see what the point is here in the illustration that I'm giving you. So Rosenberg says there is no self, no soul, no person. Scientism, remember that was our term from this morning? Scientism is the belief that science has all the answers. Scientism must firmly deny its existence. The self, as conveyed to us by introspection, is a fiction. It doesn't exist. I just want people to understand that if you're going to just dismiss Christianity and decide, I think the smart course in life is to be an atheist, that according to this atheist philosopher, what you are choosing to believe is you don't choose and you don't believe and you don't think and you don't even exist other than just a swirling mass of atoms. And what you think is consciousness, as C.S. Lewis put it one time, is just the crashing of atoms in your skull. And what this also means is all of the things that we think reflect our conscious experience, color. Are any of you colorblind? By chance, I'm just kind of curious. Any colorblind? You can't see me raise my hand. Oh, yes, all right. So we do have one colorblind person in here. Taste, pain. All of those things that are awareness from our conscious experience are just an illusion. Did you hear me? What you think you see, taste, feel, hear, is just an illusion. That's why you probably can't make out the subtitle. But the subtitle is Enjoying Life Without Illusions. Morality, thinking, free will, and consciousness, he says, are illusions. So let me illustrate it like this. How many of you have ever seen something like this before? Raise your hand if you've ever seen this, all right? Yeah. And if you didn't raise your hand, be grateful. But you will someday. All right, so I go see the doctor, and he takes a look at my knee, and he asks me, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much pain are you in? And or on the scale of happy face to frowny face, what scale of pain are you in? But of course, that's my conscious experience of pain, right? Different people have different levels of conscious experience of pain. Well, someone who shares the same view as Rosenberg wrote this: you don't feel pain. The absurdity of saying nobody has ever felt a pain is no greater than that of saying nobody's ever seen a demon. In other words, it's just as superstitious to believe in demons as it is to believe you have a conscious experience of pain. It would be simpler for us if you would say, my C fibers are firing, instead of saying, I'm in pain. Lauren, you should try that sometime as a nurse. When a patient's complaining, just say, hey, your C fibers are firing. Knock it off here, okay? Well, of course, this is insanity. We all know intuitively that we have a conscious experience of pain. But if you agree with the worldview of atheism, then you have to say that the conscious self does not exist. But it even gets much worse. Now, if you want to know how could it get much worse, well, remember this morning I talked with you about the idea that science has all the answers. If you can't prove it scientifically, you can't prove it. And that's what is called scientism. And the argument goes like this. Science and technology have made it possible to, like, for example, predict the future. And by the way, we saw an amazing example of that, I thought, this last week with Hurricane Dorian. Because when you're looking at the radar and you see this gigantic storm just like hovering off of the coast of Florida for days, you're thinking, how is this not going to hit us? But because of the modeling they have and the weather troughs that they were talking about, they could speak not with 100% certainty, but with quite a bit of accuracy that what's going to happen is instead of hitting us directly, it's going to make a turn north. And that's exactly what, I mean, that's an amazing example of science technology at work. And of course, we can go back and study natural history, and we can see certain patterns and make certain discoveries and connect certain dots in the past. Because we can have a conscious experience and think about these things and choose to study them. But guess what? If you can't think and you're not conscious and you have no free will, can you do any of that? So Rosenberg says this: science must deny the notion that we ever really think about the past and the future, or even that our conscious thoughts ever give any meaning to the actions that express them. Did you see that? We can't think about the past and we can't think about the future. And he says that's what science tells us. But that was the whole basis of belief in scientism. So guess what you've just denied? You even denied the power of science to give any answers. And so the evidence for scientism doesn't exist. So just to illustrate what all of this means on a practical level, I want to share with you, first of all, a disgraceful story from my childhood. And I hope that he never watches this lesson. He's a Facebook friend of mine. His name is John Brooks. We went to elementary school together. We were in the third grade class together. And one day where we were sitting at a table, and John had the crayons. And I wanted the crayons. And he wouldn't give me the crayons. And so I started to wring his neck until he gave me the crayons. Now, I'm not proud of this. I'm certainly not encouraging this. I'm just telling you, it's what I did. So I got reprimanded. So I am reflecting on whether I should have chosen to cause pain to John Brooks to get the colored crayons. Now, every word of that statement makes sense based on what I believe about God, the soul, morality, free will, thinking, and consciousness. But if you accepted the conclusions of Alex Rosenberg in his book, how many of those statements would actually be valid? Well, remember, there is no such thing as morality, so there's no such word as should. So we would have to scratch that off, right? And there's no such thing as free will of making choices. So I could not have chosen to cause pain, and I could not have chosen to get the colored crayons. So I would have to eliminate all of those words. And, of course, there is no conscious experience of pain. And so I would have to take away the statement cause pain. But remember, consciousness also has to do with sensing things like color. So I'd have to take the word colored off. And because there is no conscious self, I would have to take John Brooks off, and I would have to take me off. And of course, to reflect on things is an ability of consciousness. So I would have to take reflecting off. Do you know all that's left? Crayons. Colorless crayons. And that is the atheist's guide to reality. Now, if you intuitively think there is more to existence than colorless crayons, I think you're right. So far as I can see, the only advantage of Professor Rosenberg's work is that if you get drunk, naked, and catch your house on fire trying to bake cookies, you weren't conscious to ever experience that. That's the only advantage I can see to that. Otherwise, I think we all realize there's more to life. And at least what I hope tonight by talking about these things is that maybe if you've had doubts, I've pried the door open enough that you might consider further whether there actually is more to reality than colorless crayons, which is the one I want to talk about next Sunday morning, Lord willing. But before we close tonight, would you turn with me to the book of James, to the second chapter? I just want to make one basic point. I'm doing these lessons because we're focusing on building faith, and there's more to faith than the intellect, but certainly that's a big part of it. We also have a lot of high school and college students and young adults that I want to make sure I do my very best to do what I can to help address questions they have. But I think, obviously, the fact that you're here tonight means you must be a believer, or else you're faking it pretty good. So I never feel like it's good to preach and leave everybody off the hook. I feel like if I'm doing my job as a preacher, everybody's got to be challenged somehow or another. So this statement in James chapter 2 is what I want to leave you with tonight. What good is it, verse 14, what good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Clearly there is such a thing as philosophical atheism, but there is also something called practical atheism. And that's when people claim to be believers, but there is practically no difference because their faith is not alive in the way that James talks about here. So I want to challenge all of us not to think about a lesson like this as, oh, how terrible that those people might think that. But rather, I would like for us all to think about, okay, if I'm really going to claim to be a believer, just exactly how am I living in keeping with those beliefs? That's the question we'd like for you to ponder tonight as we sing the invitation song that's